State ex rel Jamie Sawalski versus Judge Robert W. Peeler. For the appellant, Mr. Pagan.
Morning. May it please the court, Madam Chief Justice, Your Honors, in this case, there are three categories of arguments that I contend will carry the day for my client. And I think I neglected to ask for 4 minutes of rebuttal time, and that's what I'll do at this time. The three categories of arguments relate to procedural bar, violations of Marcy's law, and the merits question of the prohibition claim. Because Marcy's law is a new law, because I think the bench and bar would benefit from case law development on it, I'd like to focus my argument at the beginning of my argument here on the Marcy's law violations that I argue here bar the relator's claim. There are three sub-arguments here. All come from the text of Marcy's law. The first argument is that below, in the rights restoration proceeding, the victim failed to request the relief that she's asking for here. That is a bar to her claim. That argument draws specifically from the text of Marcy's law, specifically 10AB, which says, if the relief sought below is denied, the victim can take a petition. It is undisputed here that the victim did not make the claims that are being presented here. Below, the victim gave an unsworn statement that asked the court to overrule the petition for rights restoration, but made no claims about the scope of the restoration statute or jurisdiction. Based on the clear text of Marcy's law, our argument is that the relator, the victim here, has forfeited her claim, has violated Marcy's law, and you can't reach the merits because of that violation. The second specific Marcy's law violation that we have is that the rights restoration proceeding in front of Judge Peeler is not a qualifying proceeding where enumerated rights from Marcy's law can be litigated. Again, this argument comes from the very text of Marcy's law. Again, it's section 10AB. And that language says that the victim can assert an enumerated right from 10AA in any proceeding involving the criminal offense against the victim or where the victim's rights are implicated. That wasn't the type of proceeding that we had below. The proceeding we had below was litigated under 29-23-14. That's the rights restoration statute. It was a civil case that dealt with my client's collateral disability. It was not a criminal case. It didn't involve the elements of DV. It didn't involve the DV sentence. Because it wasn't a criminal proceeding, and because it wasn't a proceeding where the victim's rights were implicated. Instead, my client's collateral disabilities were implicated. We did not have a qualifying proceeding where rights, where Marcy's law rights could be litigated and could be petitioned from.
That counsel, is a counsel. Was your client under a state law disability?
No.
So how does that impact the ability for restoration of rights when it is a federal disability, correct?
That's correct. So Congress passed a statute that allowed the states to lift federal disabilities under state law. That's 18 USC 921A3B2.
All right.
Ohio legislature enacted 29-23-14 to lift both state disabilities that qualify and federal disabilities.
Was it the qualifying federal disability, though? Was it under USC 922G9?
Right. He was disqualified under 922G9. All domestic violence offenders throughout the United States are. But Congress gave an escape route, which was permitting the states to undo that disability under state law as it saw fit under 921A33BII. The question before Judge Peeler was whether or not our legislature had intended 29-23-14, which is the rights restoration statute, to apply to DV offenders. And there's arguments on both sides. We carried the day below. And in fact, the prosecutor and I stipulated that based on our review of the law, we believed that the General Assembly had intended for that in 29-23-14.
Wait, can you stipulate to a legal conclusion?
For purposes of that hearing, we stipulated to the court that both sides believed that the petitioner was eligible.
Well, wait. So you just made up the law, right?
No, we didn't. I don't think that that's fair to say. We both presented to the court that our reading of both 29-23-14 and Section 3 from House Bill 54 from 2011. Gave DV offenders the right under the statute 29-23-14 to make application. I suppose that it was up to the trial court to determine whether or not that was appropriate. The trial court did, and that was the posture of the case. If the victim in this case believed that that was erroneous, if she contested that particular point of law, it was incumbent upon her to intervene in that civil case, make those arguments, and take a direct appeal, which she did not do. That was her.
But you just said a minute ago that these claims didn't involve a victim. It wasn't her victim's rights weren't implicated in this hearing. So which way is it?
No, I mean she was a victim of the domestic violence offense, but the claim that she's making here is not a victim's right that's enumerated under Marcy's law, section 10AA. So I'm not being inconsistent. I'm not pushing back on the fact that she was a victim, but there are certain rights and certain qualifying proceedings that victims can make, and that's where the victim has failed here, if that makes sense. Marcy's law isn't some carte blanche law that allows victims to make claims in any proceeding, in any circumstance, on direct appeal or writs, there are limitations. I've gone through some of the limitations in the Marcy's law. You have to make the claim below. That was not done here. It has to be a qualifying proceeding, which is a criminal action. This was a civil action.
So you're kind of arguing an exhaustion of remedies. So isn't our standard of review abuse of discretion?
No.
On whether she exhausted remedies.
I want to emphasize again and again, this is not a standard presentment or exhaustion claim. The language from Marcy's law itself, the clear text, the unambiguous text says, if the relief sought is denied below, the victim then can take a petition. So you are, I think you as a judge are directed to that language to determine whether or not that was satisfied so that a Marcy's law claim can be adjudicated later. If not, it's been forfeited. And that's what happened here. Below at the trial, the victim, and this is another point that I want to make, the victim did make an appearance. The court let her make a statement. The statement was about the DV facts, but there was no presentation from her or from the prosecutor that there was no jurisdiction or that the petition was outside 29-23-14. And so that is a forfeiture under the text, the explicit, unambiguous text of Marcy's law. And honestly, that is the easiest way for this court to resolve this case, by resorting to that. Let me go on with the Marcy's law violations, because I haven't exhausted them all. As I said, there was the failure to present the claim below, not a qualifying proceeding, but there's also an issue that I would characterize as standing, but it doesn't relate to, you know, the common law standing rules. Instead, Marcy's law, the text, the unambiguous text of it, has a standing provision too. And it says that a victim is permitted to assert rights enumerated in Marcy's law, which would be the 10 rights from Section 10AA. The victim in this case is not making a 10AA victim's right argument to you. Instead, in the way this case is postured, there is a claim that that the trial court below lacked subject matter jurisdiction, and that it, and that the trial court below exceeded the scope of 2923.14. That is not a Marcy's Law right that the victim has the right to assert and make claims for, either in the trial court or in, on an extraordinary writ like we have here. And so that provision of Marcy's Law was also violated. So let me summarize and then make
a question of jurisdiction. It's never waived. It can be brought up at any time.
Yes, jurisdiction can be brought up at any time. I appreciate that. There's a difference between an error in the exercise of jurisdiction and jurisdiction. I think this court makes that point time and time again, and especially recently. And I think that the claim here would be that if Judge Peeler got it wrong, he got it wrong in the exercise of his jurisdiction and not the power to hear the case itself. It is absolutely 100% undisputed that the legislature, the Ohio legislature, gave trial courts the power to remove disabilities under 2923.14. That power is there. That was the power that Judge Peeler was exercising when he made it, when he made his determination to restore my client's gun rights. If he made a mistake and Congress had not intended for that, that's a mistake in the exercise of jurisdiction, but not the power to hear the case or decide the case in the first instance, which is what prohibition asks. And before I leave, my Marcy's Law argument, I do want to make clear that the purpose, the intent, the spirit of Marcy's Law was completely honored in this case, despite the fact that it was a civil restoration trial, and we did have a trial. The Warren County prosecutor notified the victim. The victim was present. The victim was heard. The victim was allowed to give an unsworn statement free from cross-examination in opposition to my client's rights restoration. And Judge Peeler listened to and used the victim's statements in making his decision. She was given notice, respect, all the enumerated qualified rights from Marcy's Law and 10AA were complied with. What the victim is trying to do here is make legal claims like parties make about jurisdiction, statutory construction, and the scope of a statute. And Marcy's Law was never intended to give victims that power, especially the power to make decisions about legal issues over and above what the state prosecutor and I decided were, and the judge decided were appropriate. Because if that if Marcy's Law is extended that way, then what you're going to find is that victims will be making claims about in motions to suppress in criminal cases, or making arguments about jury instructions or lesser included offenses. And Marcy's Law was not intended to give victims that authority and that power, but that's what's really being done here. I've completed my argument about Marcy's Law. Again, if you're going to make a Marcy's Law claim, you have to comply with Marcy's Law, and Marcy's Law was not complied with by the victim in the three ways that I've enumerated. There's also a procedural bar that relates to res judicata. If you remember from the facts of this case, Judge Peeler's decision was a final decision. There was no appeal, and this extraordinary writ application is a collateral attack on a final judgment. We believe that res judicata would also be a procedural bar here. And then, if I could address the prohibition,
you're saying she should have intervened as a party under Marcy's Law so that she could appeal to avoid res judicata, right?
I'm saying that she should have intervened under Civil Rule 24, not under Marcy's Law, because it was a civil action. And she was given the authority under Civil Rule 24 to intervene, to become a party, and to make the very arguments that she's making here. She sat on her rights. She didn't do that. She was disappointed by the decision and is now seeking extraordinary relief when there was an adequate legal remedy at law, intervening in the civil case and making those claims on direct appeal.
Which I think she could have intervened in an action where the judge did not have the power to act, right?
Sorry.
She should have intervened in the action where the judge didn't have the power to act, except to deny it, which he didn't do, and basically that's what you're saying. And so
no, I'm saying if she has a claim, if she had a claim about the scope of 29-23-14 and whether or not it extended to DV offenders, and if she had a claim about jurisdiction, and she was put on notice, because she was, that the state was not going to make a jurisdiction argument or a scope of the statute argument, that she had the right to intervene and make those claims because she was an interested party. But she did not do that. And she should have. Because that's an adequate remedy of law. I mean, I think now that argument now is moving towards the merits of the prohibition claim.
And so one last thing on this. So sure. What would be her interest in intervening? Would it be under Marcy's law, or would it be as a victim? What would be her interest that a judge could grant either permissive joinder or mandatory?
When she gave her statement, I won't say testify because she didn't testify. She wasn't subject to cross examination. When she gave her statement, she expressed what her interest was, and she claimed that my client was not a suitable person for gun restoration.
No, I'm saying legally, what basis would she offer for why she should be permitted to intervene in that civil action?
Well, and I'm explaining that she was coming out of a divorce with him. She felt threatened by him. She did not want him to have a gun. She has a right under Marcy's law to, you know, reasonable safety. She didn't think that he was a suitable candidate for the judge to balance the factors and find that he's been rehabilitated. And that was her interest, to oppose his gun right restoration.
So her interest was because of Marcy's law, right?
Her interest included a potential Marcy's law claim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll reserve the rest. Thank you.
You've used your time. Okay, we'll start with Ms. Well.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Elizabeth Well, and I represent appellee Jamie Sawalski. I want to start with a point that Mr. Pagan just raised, because I think it really goes to the heart of this matter. All of these issues are somewhat tied in together, whether she had standing, whether she should have intervened. And I think to answer those questions, as Mr. Pagan said, we look to the plain language of the Marcy's Law Amendment. The plain language provides explicit standing for Ms. Sawalski. And the rights that she asserted pursuant to that plain language were the rights under 10AA to safety and reasonable protection. As Mr. Pagan just described, Ms. Sawalski was notified of the underlying trial court proceeding. She attended that proceeding. And we can assume, although the record isn't clear, that the reason that the prosecutor provided her notice and the reason that the court allowed her to be heard is because there was some acceptance there that her rights as a victim were implicated in that proceeding. And the criminal offense was absolutely involved in that proceeding, because but for the criminal offense, that proceeding never would have taken place. There would have been no need for Mr. Ewing to seek relief from a disability if he had never been convicted of domestic violence in the first place. So when we look to the plain meaning of the constitutional terms like assert, which is to say that something is so, Ms. Sawalski attended the trial court proceeding and she let the court know that she was concerned for her safety and reasonable protection if Mr. Ewing, who was convicted in a trial of domestic violence against her, was able to use, obtain, and possess firearms. All Marcy's Law requires is that, an assertion at the trial court level on the part of the victim. It doesn't require a sworn statement. Many of our appellate courts have taken up this issue already. And as we know, most victims are not going to have counsel, especially not at the trial court level. And so when the Ohio citizens passed Marcy's Law, there was an acknowledgement of that. And then an assertion to be sufficient under Marcy's law only needed to be saying something is so. That's the plain meaning. And of course, in that proceeding, as I said, her rights were absolutely implicated. Anytime we look at returning firearms to a domestic violence offender, a victim's right to safety and protection are going to be implicated there. And of course, the criminal offense was involved. So I think it's unquestionable here that Ms. Sawalski had standing. And I would note too on the res judicata issue that there's nothing in the constitutional amendment that would require Ms. Sawalski to attempt to intervene. She is only required by, as Mr. Pagan admitted, the plain and unambiguous language of Marcy's law to attend, to assert her rights. And then when her rights were denied, which they were by Judge Peeler, she has the right to petition the appellate court for review, which is exactly what she did. And she prevailed in the 12th district and the court issued a writ of prohibition. I wanna quickly also talk about the fact that not only is one element of res judicata missing here, but all the elements of res judicata are missing here. And then I will concede the rest of my time to my co-counsel, Michaela Deming, who will answer any questions that you may have about the merits of the prohibition issue. But as to res judicata, there was no valid judgment on the merits here because Judge Peeler acted outside the confines of 2923.14. As some of the questions we're getting to during Mr. Pagan's argument, 2923.14 specifically states that a trial court cannot relieve a disability, especially because this is not a state disability, when someone is otherwise disqualified. Because Mr. Ewing is federally disqualified, the trial court did not have the ability to act as it did. So there's no valid judgment there. Secondly, there's no privity.
Let me interrupt you just.
Sure.
Assume that we agree that the judge didn't have the authority to do what he did. But we think that that's an error in the exercise of his jurisdiction, not that he didn't have jurisdiction. And assume we also think that under Marcy's law, she had a right to appear, which she did below, and then she had a right, which Marcy's law said, to petition the Court of Appeals. Then how do we look at it? Can she raise arguments she didn't raise below? Help me with that.
Well, absolutely, Your Honor. I think that there's a slightly different standard here because at the time that Ms. Sawalski filed her writ in prohibition, the prevailing case law around the state said that victims were not parties to the case and as such were unable to appeal. Obviously, since then, we got this court's decision in State X Rel Thomas versus McGinty that said in some situations it would be appropriate for victims to appeal. But at that juncture, only writs were available. And I think the standard for writs is a little bit different than a direct appeal. She's not a party. She doesn't have the ability to object. And I think the other piece of it, as Justice Bruner said, is we have an absence of subject matter jurisdiction here, and that can be raised at any time, and that isn't waivable.
Well, so I think— But I guess my premise is, if I don't think it's subject matter jurisdiction, if I just think it's an error that the court made in the exercise of its jurisdiction, then because the statute gives the judge the authority to remove fire disabilities, the judge had jurisdiction, he just applied it wrongly. What then?
I understand the premise of the hypothetical, and respectfully, I disagree about the subject matter jurisdiction piece, but I think that the other thing that we have to consider here, and I think that this court maybe grappled with this in State X Rel Thomas versus McGinty, is that the Constitution guarantees victims the right to seek appellate review when their rights are violated at the trial court level. There has to be a remedy. If this court in the hypothetical acknowledges that Jamie Sawalski was a victim, she had these rights in the trial court proceeding, there has to be a remedy for her to seek appellate review, especially in a scenario like this one, Justice DeWine, where you have Mr. Ewing pursuing an avenue that isn't available to him anyway. And had he pursued an avenue that was available to him under federal law, which is a pardon, the statute that discusses pardons in Ohio absolutely would provide the ability for Ms. Sawalski to petition for review, because that is soundly within the criminal statutory scheme. And so I think given all of that, if the court truly doesn't believe that subject matter jurisdiction is lacking, and I disagree with that, I think that this case is very similar to State X Rel O'Malley versus Collier Williams. But if this court doesn't agree with that, there has to be a remedy under Marcy's Law for victims like Ms. Sawalski. So going back to res judicata, Mr. Ewing also claims that Ms. Sawalski is in privity with both the state and the trial court judge. But the mutuality of interest that this court deems the hallmark of privity is completely lacking here. Both the judge and the state, as Mr. Pagan said, conceded or stipulated away any error in subject matter jurisdiction or defect in subject matter jurisdiction and agreed that the court could do this, even though that was a legal conclusion. So Ms. Sawalski disagrees with that. That's the genesis of the writ in this case. And so she's absolutely not in privity. And, you know, as we just discussed, she couldn't have raised these issues at the trial court level, because as a victim who was unrepresented, she could not have foreseen that the trial court was going to act outside its judicial authority and make a decision to relieve Mr. Ewing's federal firearms disability, even though that's impermissible under federal and state law. And finally, these two cases don't arise out of the same transaction or occurrence, because the trial court matter arose out of the application, which was unlawful in and of itself, and the appellate matter arose out of Judge Peeler's unlawful response to it. So we really feel Ms. Sawalski absolutely had standing, both the trial court and the 12th district, to seek the writ of prohibition, and res judicata doesn't bar this court's review. I am going to now cede the rest of my time, unless there are any questions for me, to my co-counsel, Michaela Deming, who will address more about the merits of the prohibition issue.
Ms. Deming.
Thank you, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Ms. Sawalski's prohibition action must succeed because Judge Peeler did lack subject matter jurisdiction to relieve Mr. Ewing of a federal firearms disability. Ohio's legislature has seen fit to not restrict the civil rights of misdemeanants like Mr. Ewing, and therefore Ohio cannot relieve the federally imposed disqualification. As we have heard, it is undisputed that Mr. Ewing was convicted of domestic violence misdemeanor the first degree. It is undisputed that his conviction is a qualifying domestic violence offense under federal law. And it is undisputed that the federal firearms prohibition under 18 U.S.C. 922 G9 applies to Mr. Ewing and is the sole source of his firearms disqualification. It is further undisputed that Mr. Ewing did not get his conviction expunged or set aside and did not request or receive a pardon. The only potential source of dispute that opposing counsel is raising here is in regards to this application of 29-23-14 to Mr. Ewing. Because the Ohio legislature chose to not revoke the civil rights of domestic violence misdemeanants, Judge Peeler lacked the jurisdiction to restore that federally taken firearms right. This was made clear in the case by the United States Supreme Court in Logan v. U.S., as well in the Sixth Circuit in U.S. v. Bridges. The remaining arguments that have been raised in the brief have all also been soundly defeated in the federal courts, including the Sixth Circuit repeatedly. What Mr. Ewing is asking this court to do is to override the will and the actions of both the Ohio legislature and the U.S. Congress to create a new remedy for him out of whole cloth. If Mr. Ewing wants to legally obtain or possess firearms, he must seek and be granted a pardon, or if the option under 925C is reopened, apply to ATF or pursue a remedy in federal court. And for those reasons, we ask that you affirm the 12th District's decision.
Thank you. Mr. Pagan, you've used your time, I believe. You may take a minute.
Thank you for that. What my opponents have not raised is that they want you to decide this on the merits. This is an extraordinary writ case. It's a prohibition case that decides jurisdiction and not the merits. Second, my opponents absolutely failed to address the three arguments arising from Marcy Law that show that the claim is barred. They didn't request the same relief here that they requested that was brought up below.
Counsel, if Judge Peeler exceeded his authority. Where does that put you?
That puts me at a circumstance where, as Justice DeWan said, there potentially is an error in the exercise of jurisdiction, but not subject matter jurisdiction, especially when it's clear that Congress said to states, you can do this. You can remove disabilities. Our General Assembly said you can.
Well, they said that, but under the statute, 29-23-14, he doesn't qualify.
Well, he does. He's not specifically prohibited under the statutes that there's nothing in 29. I disagree with that. There's nothing in 29-23-14 that says it's disqualified. And then what we haven't talked about is the legislature's uncodified intent that's reflected in Section 3 of House Bill 54, where they say the General Assembly is explicitly making this amendment to clarify that relief from a weapons disability granted under 29-23-14 restores civil firearm rights to such an extent that the uniform federal ban on possessing firearms does not apply. That is a clear expression of intent that it would extend to DVs. That is why Judge Peeler and I and the state prosecutor reading that language believe that it did extend to it. So while there's arguments on both sides about whether or not it extends to a DV, in order for my opponents to win, they have to show no debatable, unambiguous lack of subject matter jurisdiction. They did not take an appeal here. They talked about appellate rights in their argument. There's no appeal here. There was a final judgment from which they didn't take an appeal.
So you're basically saying that the state gun disqualification laws specifically doesn't apply to DV, but if the trial court wants to go ahead and disconnect that disqualification somehow through that language in House Bill 54, it does, right?
I didn't specifically follow your question, but you started off by saying that there's a state firearm disqualification for DVs, and that's not true. There's not one. There's only a federal.
No, I said it doesn't exist, but it. Right. I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.